this is William Fink, and this is Christogenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, December 15th, 2023. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present part 39 of our commentary on the book of Genesis, and it is titled, In the Hands of Yahweh. In Genesis chapter 25, there is a description of a pregnant Rebecca suffering from the struggle of the baby, she thought it was a baby, in her womb, where Yahweh God had answered her and told her that there were two nations in her womb, representing two distinct peoples, and that the elder would be subordinate to the younger. Much later, in Malachi chapter 4, Yahweh announced that he loved Jacob and hated Esau. But from the time they were born, Yahweh had no exchanges with Esau, while Esau evidently had never sought God. Apparently, Yahweh permitted nothing which would cause him harm, but gave him every opportunity which Jacob had also been afforded. And he only harmed himself by his own choices. So it is fully evident that Yahweh's words to Rebekah were prophetic, but he did not express his hatred for Esau until long after Esau himself had exhibited the behavior and the attitudes for which he was hated, in the words of the prophet Malachi. In the closing verses of that same chapter, Genesis chapter 25, there was an event recorded where Esau had sold his birthright to Jacob for a measly bowl of soup. That act was a vivid demonstration of the fact that Esau had despised his birthright rather than having cherished it, since in a time of discomfort, he was willing to give it away in exchange for so little. Esau, having hungered, had no thought nor care for the God who could feed him. Then in Genesis chapter 27, we had seen the rejection of Esau, and the reasons for his rejection were stated explicitly on two occasions. The first of those is in the description of Esau's wives by Moses, where at the end of Genesis chapter 26, he wrote, And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. So if Esau lost his birthright, it is a direct result of this grief which he had caused his parents, as he had taken wives of the people from whom Abraham had admonished his own servant not to procure a wife for Isaac, for which he had even bound that servant to an oath. Then, after Rebekah had made certain that Jacob received the blessing of the firstborn rather than Esau, she informed her husband as to the reasons for which she had done that, where we read, as it is recorded at the end of Genesis chapter 27, And Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as these which are of the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do me? These are not random words spoken in some context other than what had just occurred. These words were clearly spoken to Isaac in regard to the deception of Isaac by which Jacob had obtained the blessing. And Rebekah is thereby taking responsibility for that act with a full explanation of why it was done. She must have also remembered the words which Yahweh had told her when she was still pregnant 70 years earlier. Jacob's having received the blessing marked the continued fulfillment of those words. So now that Jacob had the blessing, And Rebekah did not want to see him thrown away, as Esau had already done. Her words to Jacob at the end of chapter 27 fully prove that it was for that same reason that she made sure that Esau did not receive the blessing in the first place, for his having taken as wives the daughters of Heth. But as we have also explained, while the text informs us that Esau had taken his Hittite wives when he was but 40 years of age, Jacob is not sent to Haran by his father, which we shall see here in Genesis chapter 28, until he is about 70 years of age. So from the end of Genesis chapter 25 up to this point in the narrative, at the beginning of Genesis chapter 28, a period of 30 years has elapsed. Now here, there is a sense of urgency for which Jacob is sent to Haran, as Esau has vowed to kill him. So it is at this time that Jacob had received the blessing, and within days he was sent to Haran. Here it is evident that Esau was an impulsive man who did not restrain his passions. It is also manifest that he had evidently never consulted his parents on the issue of marriage, and to him it seems that a wife was only a whole, which is a rather vulgar but blatantly honest analogy which we have made earlier in this commentary. Sadly, even today, many men are like Esau and imitate his behavior. However, in stark contrast to Esau's impulsive character, Jacob was described as a perfect, or at least as a complete man, who was reserved and who did restrain his passions. And he had even waited for 70 years for instructions from his father before he went to find a wife. So it is apparent that Jacob left his fate to God. He put himself in the hands of God. So unlike Esau, as we shall see in this chapter of Genesis, to Jacob, a wife was evidently much more than a whole. She was a heritage. When a man chooses his wife, he is choosing his heritage. Therefore, Jacob stands in contrast to Esau as an example to all men that choosing a wife men are making a choice as to whether they shall maintain their own heritage or give it up to others. Then, in that regard, as we have also witnessed and attested, here Jacob's mother Rebekah had also demonstrated the value and character of a good Christian woman as a safeguard of the heritage of her husband. Doing that, Rebekah was also acting in the interests of an obedient son, one who had waited on his father. The heritage of Abraham would be preserved by the fortitude of Rebekah and the obedience of Jacob, in contrast to the seeming indifference of Isaac in preference for his son Esau, who had clearly despised his own heritage. Then throughout the course of these events, Jacob, who knew that Esau despised his birthright when he compelled him to sell it many years earlier, certainly seems to have put his fate in the hands of Yahweh as God by waiting patiently rather than having made any rash decisions on his own to take any actions concerning his own future. Now, as it is described in the opening verses of Genesis chapter 28, Jacob's father Isaac finally realizes the significance of what his wife had done. And in acknowledgement of that, he informs Jacob that the promises of Abraham would be his, but with a certain condition, which further serves to demonstrate why Esau had been rejected, as it also fully validates the actions of Rebekah and Jacob. Clearly, Isaac told him that he would have those promises if he took a wife of his own people. So, with that, we shall commence with Genesis chapter 28. And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. This is the same warning which Abraham had given to his servant when he sent him to Paddan Aram to fetch a wife for Isaac. So we must also note that Isaac, like Jacob after him, had also never taken a wife until he received one from his father. Esau, having taken wives without his father, had erred and failed miserably by selecting wives for himself. But Abraham obtained a wife for Isaac when he was only 40, and now Jacob is 70. So Jacob patiently left himself in the hands of Yahweh his God, and remained obedient to Isaac, even in spite of the want of attention from his father, as his father had planned to leave the blessing to Esau in spite of Esau's sin. Now the word of Yahweh God is seen to be true, as Jacob is vindicated and Esau is rejected for having rejected, or at least having disregarded, the will of Abraham. The fact that after all these years, Isaac, who himself had never set foot in Paddan Aram, was conscious of his family there, demonstrates that these men were all conscious of their family history and must have heard of the acts of Abraham as well as of his enmity towards the Canaanites. As we have also seen, Esau and Jacob were 15 years old when Abraham died, so it is very likely that they knew him. So it is also quite likely that both brothers knew how and under what circumstances their parents had been married, and both of them had very likely also heard the story of the servant who was sent to Haran to bring back Rebekah. These conclusions may be dismissed as conjecture, but it is even greater conjecture to imagine that parents who are concerned with their heritage, because they had great promises from God, would fail to communicate such things to their sons over the course of at least 40 years. For example, while the historical books of Scripture record very little interaction between David and Solomon, aside from the instructions which David gave him in 1 Kings chapter 1, the entire book of Proverbs, recorded by Solomon, contains the instructions of a father to a son. In the ancient world, there were no schools as we know them, and a mother trained a son through the basic functions of life as a toddler. While once he was old enough, a father and a grandfather educated him and prepared him for life as a man. That education was provided without televisions, without cell phones, and even without printed books. Telling his son not to take wives in the manner in which Esau had taken wives, he now tells him where to find a wife. Arise, verse 2, Genesis chapter 28, arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother. In chapter 27, Rebekah is portrayed as having urgently wanted Jacob to go to Paddan Aram, as Esau had expressed a desire to kill him, where she is recorded as having said, in part, Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise. Flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and tarry with him a few days. until thy brother's fury turn away. So at this same point in the Septuagint, Genesis chapter 28, verse 2, the text maintains that urgency where the opening clause of this verse has Isaac saying, "Rise and depart quickly into Mesopotamia." There it also has Mesopotamia rather than Paddan Aram, which is a more specific area in the northwestern portion of Mesopotamia. The translators of the Septuagint made this substitution consistently, which indicates that by the 3rd century BC, the name Paddan Aram had fallen from use. Isaac continues his instructions in verse 3. "And God Almighty bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee, and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham." And rather than a multitude of people in verse 3, the Septuagint has assembly of nations, that thou mayest be an assembly of nations. The Hebrew word for multitude being kahal, which means congregation or assembly. It is often translated into Greek as synagoge or synagogue, which is a compound Greek word. The word am is properly a people, as in a nation or a tribe. And here in the plural form, amim, it was translated into Greek with the plural form of ethnos, or nations. So here Isaac tells Jacob that his descendants would be not only a nation, but a company or a large group of nations. As Genesis is written, there are several times in which Yahweh God had given promises such as these to Abraham. But there is not one time where we read that Yahweh had uttered these promises directly to Isaac. So this once again demonstrates the fact that Abraham had fully related his experiences with Yahweh to his son Isaac. And much earlier than this, in Genesis chapter 25, Isaac was fully conscious of the God of Abraham, where we read that he had entreated Yahweh for his wife because she was barren. Furthermore, speaking these words to Jacob, where Isaac referred to the blessings and promises which Yahweh had made to Abraham, Jacob must have already been familiar with those things, and therefore he, as well as his brother, must have been instructed concerning them in his youth. All of this supports our previous conjecture that Abraham and Isaac had educated their sons and related their experiences to them so that Esau had no excuse for his own actions. He purposely forsook his birthright because to him a wife was only a whole. He was a man who sought immediate gratification and had no control over his impulses. But here Isaac also tells his son Jacob to go to his own kindred to take a wife and informs him that if he does so, then under that condition, Yahweh God would bless him and give to him the blessings of Abraham. This wording also proves beyond doubt that Esau had not been blessed on account of his race-mixing fornication, as Jacob is told that he would receive the promises if he did not commit such fornication. Moreover, Jacob is 70 years old, and it is apparent that Isaac had not made such provisions for him in the past because his own focus was still on Esau. But Rebekah's actions had changed that and awakened Isaac to face, or at least to realize, the truth of the matter. So in that regard also, the words of Isaac here are an admission that Esau could not have the blessing of Abraham, because he had taken wives who were not of his own kindred, but were rather of the accursed Hittites. Perhaps, cutting Isaac some slack here, perhaps Isaac had also put his own fate into the hands of Yahweh, for which reason he did not turn his son Esau away on account of his wives. But through Rebekah's actions, which were in accord with the words which Yahweh had spoken to her when she was pregnant, Yahweh had also spoken to Isaac when he was deceived into giving Jacob the blessing. Since if Yahweh's words to Rebekah were true, that the elder shall serve the younger, then it was Jacob who was to have the blessing, since the blessing was also a prayer that all of Jacob's brethren be subject to him. So Yahweh spoke through the actions of Rebekah. He spoke to Isaac through the actions of Rebekah. Isaac immediately accepted those actions when he said, "And he shall be blessed. I've already blessed your brother, and he shall be blessed." Meaning that Isaac would not retract the blessing of the firstborn, which he had bestowed on Jacob, thinking he was speaking to Esau. Verse 5. And Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went to Paddan Aram, unto Laban, son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mother. I don't know why they didn't write the mother of Jacob and Esau, but rather than Jacob's and Esau's mother, as it also is in the Septuagint, the Latin Vulgate has only his mother in reference to Jacob. This may reflect a divergence among early Hebrew copies of the manuscripts, but evidently and unfortunately, no portion of Genesis chapters 28 through 31 had survived in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which I like to check when I believe there were divergences in the manuscripts. When Abraham had sent his servant for a wife for Isaac, Laban was already of age and answered the servant in his father's presence. For example, in Genesis chapter 24, where the servant inquired of them, we read, "Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, The thing proceeds from Yahweh," from the Lord in the text of the King James Version. "The thing proceeds from Yahweh. We cannot speak unto thee bad or good." There it is also apparent that they believed, or at least admitted, the God to whom the servant had referred. But that may have been from the perspective of their own pagan superstition, as they were still pagans who had maintained their own gods. Rebekah had spent 20 years with Isaac before she gave birth to Jacob and Esau. So now, at least 90 years later, it is certain that Bethuel has passed on, since he is not mentioned again after this time. And when Jacob arrives in Paddan Aram, it is evident that Laban is the head of the household. If we imagine that Laban was at least 30 years of age when he met Abraham's servant, and since Jacob is now 70 here, his uncle, Laban, must have been at least 50 years older, and perhaps even older than that. Here, Isaac is 130 years old. Laban is at least 120. And as I explained in my last segment of this Genesis commentary in part 38. We know that Jacob was 70 years old when he went to Haran, because later on, when Jacob goes through Egypt, Jacob tells the Pharaoh that he's 130 years old. And Joseph is only 30. So when Joseph was born, Jacob was 100 years old. I'm sorry, I'm missing 10 years somewhere. Jacob spent 20 years in Haran, and Joseph was born at the very end of that period. So perhaps Jacob was 120 years old when he went to Egypt to see the Pharaoh. I don't remember. I'm doing this without it being in my notes. I meant to put it in my notes, and I didn't. So perhaps I'll fix it for the notes before I post this presentation. But Jacob is at 70 years old here. He spent 20 years in Haran. That makes him 90 years old. Then when he returned from Haran, he went to Egypt at the age of 130 years. Joseph would have had to be 40 years old at that time. I think that's where my confusion might be. I don't remember. But I don't remember my exact calculations, so I'm sorry. But I'll fix it for the notes. This is offhand, and it's not in my notes. I should have checked. So, continuing with verse 6. But my point is that Jacob is old, and Laban is much older. Jacob's not a youth when he goes to Haran. He's 70. That's 7 years older than me, and I can't imagine starting a family today, never mind 7 years from now. But of course, we know that they lived much older at this time, so they must have been much healthier at any given age. They really must have been much healthier at 70 than at least most men are today. Verse 6, when Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take him a wife from thence, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. And that Jacob obeyed his father and mother, and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father. And here, after verse 8, that's verses 6, 7, and 8, after verse 8, we shall interrupt the account before the conclusion in verse 9. Where it finally struck Esau, after 30 years, and after he had lost his blessing, that perhaps he should not have married Canaanite women. And he realizes he must do something to rectify the situation. The words at the end of verse 8 here, pleased not Isaac, are an understatement. The Septuagint Greek and its translation by Brenton are actually much closer to the meaning of the Hebrew text. Where it says in verse 8, and Esau also, having seen that the daughters of Canaan were evil before his father, Isaac. Literally, we would translate the Hebrew of verse 8 to read, and Esau had seen that the daughters of Canaan are evil in the eyes of Isaac his father. They didn't please not Isaac, his father. They were evil in the eyes of Isaac, his father. But even though Moses also explains here that Esau had seen that Jacob obeyed his father and mother, Esau himself once again fails to consult with them as to what he may do, if anything, in order to please them. Rather, he once again takes matters into his own hands instead of committing himself into the hands of Yahweh by honoring his parents. So we read that conclusion in verse 9. Then went Esau unto Ishmael and took under the wives which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth, to be his wife. The sister of Nebaioth. This name seems to have clung to the Ishmaelites. some of whom would be called Nabataeans in later history, and even well into historical times. Although other etymologies for the modern form of the name are provided by academic historians, I don't believe the academic historians. I believe that Nabataean probably came from Nebaioth. In subsequent biblical and historical narratives, it is quite evident that the Edomites and Nabataeans remained quite close to one another throughout their history. But the Edomites also continued to mingle with the Canaanite Hurrians, the Horites of Scripture, which is fully evident in the genealogy of Esau in Genesis chapter 36. Here Esau had failed once again. Since much earlier, in Genesis chapter 21, Sarah had asserted her rights as the wife of Abraham, where we read, "Wherefore she said unto Abraham, Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. Then Yahweh upheld her words," where we continue and read, "And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. And God said unto Abraham, Let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman. In all that Sarah has said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Therefore, since Ishmael was prohibited any share in the inheritance with Isaac in this manner, Esau could not possibly please his parents by taking a wife of the daughters of Ishmael. Yet he did so on his own initiative. However, nothing more is said of the matter until we read the words of Paul of Tarsus in Hebrews chapter 12, who had spoken of Esau as an example, warning of the consequences of rebellion, and said, "Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. When Jacob received the blessing, Esau cried, but he could not get it back. And now, when he realized that he must rectify his sins, he failed once again, because neither could the progeny of Ishmael inherit the blessing. Esau is a type for the fleshly man of worldly achievement who does not consider the things of the Spirit, and he is also a type for men who do not seek the will or counsel of their fathers. So Esau is also a type for men who take the matters of life wholly into their own hands rather than seeking the counsel of Yahweh God and putting their fate into his hands. The end of those men will always follow the pattern of Esau." The pattern is manifest in chapter 3 of the Wisdom of Solomon from our own translation. "But the impious shall have punishment just as they imagined. They who have no care for the just and departing from Yahweh. For he who is despising wisdom and discipline is miserable, and their hope is empty, and labors unprofitable, and their works useless. Their wives are senseless, and their children wicked. Cursed is their origin." Esau, having neglected the will of his parents, and therefore also the will of his God, had chosen his wives senselessly. He chose senseless wives. And therefore, the origin of his children is accursed. There is a similar warning in Isaiah chapter 17, where we read, "Because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength, therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants, and shall set it with strange slips. In the day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish. But the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. That's what happens when you have bastard children. But Jacob obeyed his father. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. The presumed sites of ancient Beersheba and Haran are about 450 miles apart, as the proverbial crow flies. So Jacob must have had a trip of at least 500 miles. Since Isaac was a man with a great wealth of servants and flocks, Jacob certainly did not have to walk the journey. But even on camel, it would take him as long as 2 weeks to reach his destination. Camels doing not much more than 25 miles a day. In the world of the patriarchs, large horses, which could be ridden by men, were very rare. And they were not generally imported from Persia and points further east until much later times. So to use horses for travel, a chariot was necessary. And even then, under good conditions, a team of horses may only cover about 30 miles or so in a day. I think it was Herodotus. I'm pretty sure it was Herodotus who wrote of the trade that the Scythians had bringing large horses from Asia, from Eastern Asia, into the Greek world and sold them to the Greeks. And the Greeks, from the time they obtained those horses, were able to ride horses rather than being restricted to chariots. The Hittites had horses, but they were also restricted to chariots for the most part, because the horses native to areas of the Mediterranean basin were too small for grown men to sit on and ride, especially with armor and other burdens. Later in this chapter, we learn that this place where Jacob had stopped would become the site of Bethel, in what would later be the land of Ephraim. So it is about 50 miles northeast of Beersheba. And it is not clear whether this is Jacob's first stop, but it is unlikely that he covered such a distance in a single day. He is probably stopping here for the second night of his journey, as that would be consistent with the distance traveled thus far. Sleeping on stones, Jacob nevertheless managed to attain a deep sleep, which is evident from the dream which he had. In verse 12. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. And thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Like all other Old Testament prophecies, Jacob's ladder can only be properly understood from a Christian perspective. The significance of this dream is that the angels represent the fulfillment of the promises which are described here as having been made to Jacob concerning his seed at the very time when he had been observing these angels. Jacob's descendants, being of both the creation of Adam since he shall take wives from of his own people. And also being from of the promises which Yahweh God himself had made to him here, and to his fathers before him. It is Jacob's descendants who are therefore born from above, as they are from of Yahweh God himself, products of his promises. For that reason, Yahshua Christ is recorded as having said in John chapter 4, that unless a man should be born from above, he is not able to see the kingdom of Yahweh. So the angels on the ladder, ascending and descending from and into, or into and from heaven, represent the origin and destination of the seed which is promised to Jacob here. The wisdom of Solomon also understood this. And in chapter 19, he equated the seed of Jacob at the time of the giving of the law to a renewal of the Adamic creation, where he wrote, "For the whole creation, within its own race, was again perfectly formed from above, serving your commandments in order that your sons may be kept unharmed." Just a few verses earlier than that, Solomon had also explained that the 12 tribes of Israel are the society, or the world, of the scriptures, where he wrote near the end of chapter 18 and said, "For upon the garment reaching to the feet was the whole society, and the glory of the fathers carved upon the four rows of stones, and your majesty upon the diadem of his head," those four rows, each containing three stones, represent the 12 tribes of Israel, and they are the only tribes represented on the garment of the high priest. Furthermore, the children of Israel were Yahweh's witnesses in the earth, or I should say they are Yahweh's witnesses in the earth. And by their very presence, they are an affront to the devils and the so-called princes of this world. In that regard, they are also Yahweh's servant race, and therefore they stand as messengers or angels of the truth of God in the face of his enemies. This we read in part from Isaiah chapter 41, from verse 8, "But thou, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend." Then further on from chapter 43, from verses 1 and 10, "But now thus saith Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel," that ladder going up and down in Jacob's vision, "for I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine, ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me was no God formed, neither shall there be after me." So in that respect, living as the witnesses of Yahweh here in the earth, the children of Israel are represented by the angels, or messengers, moving up and down the ladder in Jacob's dream. Then, the fact that the messengers of Yahweh, the apostles and the prophets, all came from Israel, his word has gone out to the world, both to his adversaries as well as to his people, through the children of Israel. Therefore, the interpretation is certain. Then, as we have already remarked regarding the similar promise to what had been spoken to Jacob here, which was spoken earlier to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, where we read that in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And perceiving the Genesis account through Christian eyes, Paul of Tarsus had understood the reference to all the families of the earth, as a prophetic statement which referred to the future families of Israel, the descendants of Jacob, who inherited the promises to Abraham that his seed would inherit the earth. So Paul explained that where he wrote in Galatians chapter 3, that just as Abraham had trusted Yahweh, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, then you know that they from faith, they are sons of Abraham. And the writing, having foreseen that from faith, Yahweh would deem the nations righteous, announced to Abraham beforehand that in you shall all the nations be blessed. So those from faith are blessed along with the believing Abraham. But where Paul mentioned they from faith, he must have meant they from of the faith of Abraham. And the promise which Abraham had believed is the substance of that faith, that I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great. Now Yahweh offers a further assurance that Jacob would thereby know that he was destined to live out his entire life in the hands of Yahweh, his God. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Jacob, being in the hands of Yahweh, certainly would live out his life in that regard, even when it is seemingly to his hurt, which we shall discuss further in relation to his time with Laban, who had taken advantage of and who had exploited him, and also to the rape of Dinah, his daughter, which is recorded in Genesis chapter 34. The dream comes to an end. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely Yahweh is in this place, and I knew it not. And he was afraid, and said, how dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, the meaning of the name Bethel. And this is the gate of heaven. The vision was frightening, and therefore it must have been very powerful, even if it forebode nothing but blessings for Jacob himself. His reaction here is a pagan reaction, as the pagans traditionally saw their gods as inhabiting a particular land or area in which they were imagined to reside. But culturally, perhaps that is the only way that Jacob could have understood the dream at the time. And it is evident in many places in Scripture that God speaks to men on terms that the men themselves would understand. The story of the prophet Jonah is a remarkable example which exhibits that phenomenon. Furthermore, Jacob's interpretation of his dream need not be the same as our own, since his perspective was still mostly pagan in spite of the experiences of Abraham and Isaac. And we now have the advantage of hindsight and a Christian perspective. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put up for his pillows and set it up for a pillar. It should probably say, set them up for a pillar, perhaps, and poured oil upon the top of it. I'm sorry, I didn't check the grammar, but we have singulars and plurals going on here at the same time, describing the same stone, or stones, or pillow, or pillows. The setting up of a pillar as a witness for some event or something else having significance, which needed to be memorialized, must have also been a culturally pagan practice. Later, in Genesis chapter 31, after Rachel had stolen her father's household gods, which was unknown to Jacob, and Laban had sought them but could not find them, he set up a pillar as a memorial of an oath he would ask Jacob to make, that Jacob not come north of the pillar to do him harm. That is because the possession of the household gods gave the holder special inheritance rights to a man's estate. I will discuss that further when we reach Genesis chapter 31. So we read in part, "And Laban said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed. And Mizpah, for he said, Yahweh watches between me and thee when we are absent one from another. If thou shalt afflict my daughters," he may have said Adon there, the Lord. I really didn't get the chance to check that. "And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold this pillar, which I have cast betwixt me and thee. This heap be witness, and this pillar be witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee, and thou shalt not pass over this heap and this pillar unto me for harm. The God of Abraham, and the God of Nahor, and the God of their father, judges betwixt us," or between us. "And Jacob sware by the fear of his father Isaac," where Laban referred to the God of Nahor and the God of Terah, their father. That was not a reference to the God of Abraham, but rather Nahor was a pagan like his father Terah, as we read in Judges chapter 24. "Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time," meaning the other side of the Euphrates River, where Haran was situated. "Even Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods." The same thing is mentioned on two other occasions later in that chapter. Now Jacob names the place accordingly, and the name would cleave to it as he visits it again after he returns from Haran in Genesis chapter 35. "And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at the first." And of course, Bethel in Hebrew means house of God. Jacob imagined that Yahweh lived there when he visited him in that dream. Pagan perspective. Rather than Luz, the Septuagint has a compound word, Ulamlus, as the former name of Bethel, which we may translate it as Brenton had, as Ulam-Luz. But we cannot tell how the translators may have known that, so perhaps, or made that mistake. So perhaps a portion of that name had fallen out of the manuscript subsequent to its translation. Either way, the name is obscure, as there is no record of it in inscriptions. We don't know how that they made that mistake. If it was a mistake, we don't know. I can't find Luz in any inscriptions, ancient inscriptions. On three other occasions in Scripture, in Genesis chapter 35, Joshua chapter 18, and Judges chapter 1, we are informed that the name of Bethel was originally Luz. But in Joshua chapter 16, we read, where it is speaking of the border of Ephraim, "And the lot of the children of Joseph fell from Jordan by Jericho, unto the water of Jericho on the east, to the wilderness that goes up from Jericho throughout Mount Bethel, and goes out from Bethel to Luz, and passes along the borders of Arki to Ataroth." And I'll stop there. In the Septuagint version, Luz is not mentioned at all in verse 2, and it seems to be more trustworthy in that regard, because if Bethel is Luz, how could you get from Bethel to Luz? I mean, it's silly. Now Jacob commits himself, in response to this vision, Jacob commits himself into the hands of Yahweh. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall Yahweh be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. And again, we see the pagan perspective in the stone being designated as God's house. Jacob's father Abraham had unconditional promises from God. And these promises made to Jacob here are also given without condition. Even if his father Isaac had given him the condition that he marry women of his own kindred. So like Abraham, here Jacob vows to act accordingly and to remain faithful to the God of the promises, even though nothing in return was requested of him. So with that, it is evident that the character of Jacob is very much like the character of Abraham. Furthermore, there were no conditions or obligations laid upon Jacob here on account of the promises to his ancestors, especially on the account of the unconditional promises to Abraham. So when Paul had explained that the children of the promise are counted for the seed in Romans chapter 9, where he discussed the promise which Yahweh had given to Rebekah, he wrote, then not yet having been born, nor having performed any good or evil, that the purpose of Yahweh concerning the chosen endures, not from rituals, but from the calling. To her it was said, the elder will serve the younger, just as it is written, Jacob I love, and Esau I hated. So the purpose of God in having called Abraham is established in Jacob, but it could not be established in Esau, and Esau's own deeds had brought him to that fate, in spite of the fact that Yahweh, being God, had foreseen his errors, as his promise to Rebekah also illustrates. Hear Jacob's words, where he asks that God will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on. Evoke the words of Christ as they are found in Luke chapter 12. Then he said to his students, verse 22, for this reason I say to you, do not have care for the soul, what you should eat, nor for the body, what you should be clothed in. Jacob's looking for that from God. For the soul is greater than food, and the body than clothing. Observe the crows, that they do not sow, nor do they harvest. With them is no treasury nor storehouse, and Yahweh feeds them. How much more are you worth than the birds? Who caring among you is able to add a cubit to his stature? Therefore, if you are not able to do the least, why should you care about the rest? Observe the lilies, how they grow. Neither do they labor, nor do they spin yarn. But I say to you, not even Solomon in all his honor was clothed as one of these. And if the grass is in the field today, and tomorrow, being cast into a furnace, Yahweh clothes thusly, how much more you, you of little faith? Then you do not seek what you should eat and what you should drink, and do not get excited. For all these things the nations of the society seek after. But your father knows what you have need, that you have need of these things. Moreover, you seek his kingdom, and these things shall be added to you. Fear not, little flock, because it has pleased your father to give you the kingdom. This is the attitude which Jacob had. And according to Christ himself, it is also the attitude which all Christians should have in regard to those things. That doesn't mean that a man should not work. It means that a man should work hoping to maintain his goods so that he could have food and clothing. I believe in Ecclesiastes, Solomon had said that a man is blessed when he gets to keep the fruit of his own hands, when he gets to keep the fruits of his own labors. He's cursed when the government taxes them 90%, and then some nigger comes and steals the other 10%. Okay. Jacob's journey continues. So we shall commence with a few verses from Genesis chapter 29. Then Jacob went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east. And here it seems that Haran might more appropriately have been considered to have been in the north rather than the east. Traveling from Beersheba to Haran in straight lines, first going east and then turning north, so that one doesn't have to swim. One would have to walk about 250 miles east and then over 380 miles north in order to accomplish the journey. But perhaps Haran was esteemed to be in the land of the east rather than in the land of the north, simply because it was in Mesopotamia, which was generally considered to be east of Canaan. Verse 2, Genesis chapter 29. And he looked, and behold, a well in the field. And behold, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks. And a great stone was upon the well's mouth. And thither, or there, were all the flocks gathered. And they rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the sheep, and put the stone again upon the well's mouth in its place. And the text here is only explanatory, since when Jacob speaks to the shepherds in the subsequent verses, the sheep have not yet been watered. Evidently, there was no structure built up around the well, which is sort of crude, but perhaps for some reason it was not feasible to build one, as wells are often temporary or even seasonal. So a stone rolled over the mouth of a well would keep animals and even people from falling into it, especially at night. You'll trip over the stone, but you won't fall down the well. And Jacob said unto them, verse 4, My brethren, whence be ye, or from where are you? And they said, Of Haran we are. And he said unto them, Know ye Laban the son of Nahor? And they said, We know him. And he said unto them, Is he well? And they said, He is well. And behold, Rachel his daughter comes with the sheep. As we had said, since Laban spoke to Abraham's servant, along with his father Bethuel, he must have been of age at that time, so he was at least 30 years old. Now, 90 years later, he is at least 120, or about 10 years younger than Isaac, if he was only 30 when he saw Abraham's servant. He may have been much older. We are never told the age of Rachel, but of course she must have been able to bear children. So ostensibly, she was significantly younger than Jacob. And now saying that, I suddenly remembered why I have a 10-year discrepancy in my chronology. It's because Joseph in Egypt is 30 years old, nearly 10 years before Jacob sees Pharaoh at 130 years old. So by then, Joseph is 40. So Jacob had Joseph in Haran, the last of his sons born there, who was born very shortly before Jacob departed from Haran. Jacob had Joseph 40 years before he appeared in Egypt, so he had Joseph when he was 90 years old. Then, seeing that Jacob was in Haran for 20 years, he was 70 years old when he went to Haran. It was 20 years between the time that Isaac married Rebekah and they had Jacob and Esau. So that's 90 years in the life of Laban. And Laban was already of age when he first spoke to Abraham's servant. He had to be of age to have any authority at all in the house. I would think that would be 30 years old. I would think. I can't. That's conjecture, but I can't do any better than that. So here, Laban has to be at least 120 years old. But here, Isaac, when Jacob is 70, Isaac is 130 years old. And Laban's going to live at least another 20 years until Jacob departs from Haran. I don't want to be that old for that long. I'm sorry. Verse 7. Or I'm not sure if I finished what I was reading. As we had said, since Laban spoke to Abraham's servant along with his father Bethuel, he must have been of age at that time, so he's at least 30 years old. I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself. I'm going to skip on. We may never know the age of Rachel. I think that's where I left off. We're never told her age. But of course, she must have been able to bear children. So ostensibly, she was significantly younger than Jacob. We don't know how old she was. Laban's already 120, but he could have easily had her at age 80 or 90. And she could be 40 here and still be able to bear children. Isaac was 40 when he married Rebekah. We're not told how old Rebekah was, but she must have been of age. She's described as a beautiful woman in the bloom of youth when the servant takes her to Isaac. And she doesn't have children for another 20 years. She may have been 50 years old when she had those children. People were healthier for a longer period of time at this period in history. Verse 7, and he said, lo, it is yet high day. Neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water ye the sheep and go and feed them. And this is Jacob speaking to these servant boys, or these shepherd boys, I should say. And it is apparent that they're only youths or boys in the next couple of verses. But of course, Jacob had experience with cattle, as he must have helped to manage his father's flocks and herds for at least 50 years. Here the word cattle is used as opposed to sheep. So while sheep may be part of the cattle, generally speaking, here the word for cattle, mikna, is evidently used to describe larger animals that were not the sheep. Neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water ye the sheep and go feed them. The two are in opposition to one another, or apposition. The word mikna is described by Strong's in part as something bought, i.e. property, but only livestock. So I guess it only referred to livestock that was traded and sold and exchanged in trade. And they said, we cannot until all the flocks be gathered together. And they rolled the stone. The word till there is added in the King James. Until they rolled the stone from the well's mouth, then we water the sheep. Okay, so these shepherds must be youths because they are not big enough and strong enough to roll the stone from the well's mouth. They're saying, and till they roll the stone from the well's mouth, then we water the sheep. So that indicates that these shepherds were young and perhaps not strong enough yet to roll the stone for themselves. But Jacob would not have known how many sheep there were to gather. He just came on the scene, right? So the shepherds would wait until they all came together so that they would not have to remove the stone and replace it more than once, even if they could roll it. But apparently they could not. And while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. And here we don't know if Rachel was the keeper of her father's sheep or a keeper of her father's sheep, since we never learn whether the young shepherds, those who evidently could not move the stone, belonged to Laban or to another man in the area. It was also evidently uncommon at least, for women to be a shepherd, since I could not locate another example outside of references to pagan idols. Sometimes the goddesses of the pagans were addressed as shepherdesses, but that's the only examples I find. I don't find one in ancient inscriptions, and I searched a few books. In ancient inscriptions, I can't find one reference to a woman who's acting as a shepherd or working as a shepherd. It's all men. Sorry, ladies. Okay. Rachel must have been a tomboy. I'm kind of kidding, but she kept her father's sheep, at least. There are references to shepherd boys in the inscriptions. For example, in an Akkadian fable titled Dispute Between the Date Palm and the Tamarisk, where we read in part as the date palm brags, "My cluster is luxuriant. Though I lift it high, shepherd boys make out of it big sticks." And that's a pretty old Assyrian inscription. It probably dates to about 1300 BC, perhaps. Not quite as old as Jacob. "And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth." So Jacob did it alone, but the boys must have been too young. "And watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Finally, laying eyes on Rachel for the first time." In verse 11. "And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept." Evidently, Jacob loved Rachel as soon as he had seen her, just as Isaac had loved Rebekah as soon as he had seen her. However, the circumstances were quite different. And from this point, Jacob would have to wait another 14 years to have her as his wife. Yahweh willing, we shall return next week to resume our Genesis commentary with this verse. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. Good night.